and see who it was pulling up outside, only to be disappointed by the closed sign. He liked the whole damn concept of inside as an inside information, claiming it was the only kind that was worth anything, and letting on that he was in sole possession of loads of it, which, now that Janine thought about it, probably was why he never surrendered any. If you told somebody, you'd just let it outside. The good news was that Walt didn't even look the 50 he'd admitted to before this morning. He looked mid-40s, a few years older than Miles and Janine herself, and his being 50, so she'd thought, was something to be proud of. Janine had considered it inspirational, in fact. If her future husband could look that good at 50, then Janine had another solid decade of wearing tight jeans and thin halters without looking ridiculous. But 60? 60 was no inspiration. It was a damn deception. And it had occurred to Janine at the moment her index finger pinned Walt's birth certificate to the countertop that what she was doing amounted to trading in a man who couldn't keep a secret for a man who not only could but did. And he wasn't just keeping his secrets from other people, he was keeping them from her, too. Which he denied, naturally, claiming he thought she'd known that he was 60 all along. He even showed her his driver's license, which said the same damn thing. "When did I ever tell you I was 50?" he asked her on the courthouse steps. Well, it was true she couldn't exactly remember a specific occasion, a direct lie sworn under oath, but she hadn't invented the goddamn thing either. How many times over the last year had they joked about the decade's difference between their ages, and he just stood there grinning, the silver fox, and never once correcting her, never once saying, "I got news for you, darling. We're not talking one decade here, we're talking two." "What's the difference?" he said as they drove home, pretending not to understand why she was so upset. "You know what great shape I'm in. I've got the body of a 40-year-old man. You said so yourself. Where's the problem?" "The problem is you lied to me, Walt," Janine said, realizing that, of course, this too was a lie, and hating herself for it. That he had lied was the reason she should have been upset with him, but it wasn't. The reason she was upset was that she'd been looking forward to at least 20 years' worth of spirited, vigorous sex, having largely missed out on the last 20 by being married to Miles. But by the time she was 60, she'd be humping an octogenarian, or trying to. Discovering the silver fox's correct age also explained why on a couple of recent occasions, Walt, who for a small man was well hung, God love him, had required considerable manual assistance to get out of the gate. What if in a few short years, all her well-hung man did was hang? Janine glanced over at her mother, to whom she hadn't breathed a word of this, because she knew how hard B would laugh. She was, after all, another tragic example of how much God seemed to enjoy frustrating the shit out of women. "If you're cold, why not put on that sweatshirt?" B wanted to know. Janine had brought a sweatshirt along for later in the afternoon, in case it turned chilly, which it had done already. "You see, Beatrice, you answered your own question. I'm not cold."
"Yeah? Well, your nipples tell a different story."
Janine regarded her mother murderously before responding and refused to look down at her thin cotton halter. "Don't trouble yourself about my nipples, okay, Mother? I happen to be enjoying the sun on my shoulders, if that's okay with you. We probably aren't going to see a warm day like this again until the middle of goddamn May, so leave me alone." Her plan, Janine had to admit, was flawed from the start. She hadn't thought much past her entrance, which, even if it had gone as planned, would have lasted no more than 5 minutes, after which she'd be stuck with her mother's company for 3 hours. There was some kind of law that applied to situations like this one. The law of something, something. Never mind, it had come to her. Either that or she'd forget the question, which would be just fine, too. 60, though. That was going to take a while to forget. Janine knew from experience that it was a lot easier to forget 1,000 things you wanted to remember than the one thing you wanted to lose sight of. Again, she spotted Walt on the sideline. Since she learned this morning that the Silver Fox was 60, he was beginning to look 60, which was just plain nuts, she knew. How could a man who didn't look 50 yesterday suddenly look 60 today, just because of a date printed on a piece of yellowing folded paper? It wasn't rational. But when Walt Como turned around, peered up into the stands to where Janine and her mother were sitting, and started waving, all Janine could see was that thing on his neck. What the hell was that? A wattle? Why hadn't she ever noticed it before? "Who's that woman sitting over there with Miles?" her mother wanted to know. She hadn't noticed the Silver Fox waving up at them and certainly wasn't waving back. "Where?" said Janine. "Miles? With a woman?" She promised herself not to be jealous unless it turned out to be Charlene. "Right across from us. Except way up, top." That figured, Janine thought. God must have gotten his wires crossed as usual. Somebody named Roby had wanted seats high in the bleachers, so he gave them to Miles. "Looks like that Whiting girl," B said, as Janine scanned the crowd for someone who looked like her soon-to-be ex-husband. "It'd serve you right, too. You divorce that good man, and he marries into the richest family in Central Maine and then lives happily ever after, and you get the little banty rooster." "Diminishing returns," Janine said, regarding her mother with undisguised malice. "What?" "The law of diminishing returns. I was trying to remember that a minute ago, and you just reminded me." Her mother squinted at her now, as if, despite her daughter's proximity, Bea was having trouble bringing her into focus. "I swear, Janine, it's not just weight you've lost." Janine ignored this, having gone back to searching the stands. It took her another minute to locate him, because she was looking for a couple, and instead he appeared to be part of a threesome, the third person being that policeman Miles particularly disliked, the one she'd seen parked across from the restaurant one evening last week, just sitting there. Jimmy Minty. She watched him get to his feet and start to say something, but then a roar went up, and Janine saw that there'd been a fumble down on the field. By the time she spotted Miles and the Whiting woman, if that's who it was, Janine had to admit she was going to have to get her eyes checked real soon since she couldn't see for shit anymore. The policeman had disappeared into the crowd. Was it her imagination, or had they been squabbling right before the fumble? "I hope Miles hasn't gone and done something to piss off that Minty boy," said her mother, whose eyesight apparently was fine. "He's his old man reincarnated, and William Minty was as purely sneaky and mean as they come. He was the only man your father and I ever 86'd for life." Janine again regarded her mother, surprised to feel something like fear on Miles's behalf. Fortunately, fending off that emotion wasn't too hard. After all, Miles Roby was no longer Janine's problem, and she forced herself not to look back toward him and the crippled woman, who, if she was seeing right, had hooked her arm through his. She returned her attention to the Silver Fox, who now had an audience of three out-of-work mill workers and was feeding them some line of bullshit or other. She could tell because he was standing with his feet and arms wide apart, the way he always did when he was telling a story, as if from a pitching deck on high seas. Yes, it was Walt, not Miles, who was about to become her problem, unless she changed her mind in one hell of a hurry, which she was not going to do, she decided, for the simple reason that she wouldn't allow her mother the satisfaction of an "I told you so." She would marry Walt, all right, just like she'd been threatening, even if it was true that he'd planned to keep his old age a secret, even if he did have a waddle. It was that Whiting girl across the way, though. Now that her mother had identified her, Janine was sure of it. Not that Cindy was a girl anymore. She looked like she'd put on some weight, which for her was a good thing. The last time Janine had seen her, she looked like somebody in the last days of a prison hunger strike. It was possible they actually were dating, of course, but the more Janine thought about it, The more she feared that this was some kind of a predicament that Miles had gotten himself into, and she couldn't help wondering how. She knew he was terrified of the woman, who'd been in love with him and even tried to kill herself over him, an idea Janine had always considered comical. In her opinion, being married to Miles was what inspired thoughts of self-annihilation. Failing to marry him should have been cause for celebration in any sensible woman. Of course, Cindy Whiting, by all accounts, was not a sensible woman, which was why she'd spent half her adult life in institutions. What in the world could have induced Miles to lower his guard this way? Well, he was a master at trapping himself, of course, but Janine still would have liked to know how he'd managed it this time. In fact, she felt a strong urge to call him up after the game and ask. Since their separation, what she found herself missing most were little things, like listening to Miles try to explain how he'd yet again got himself talked into doing what he'd just sworn never to do again. He wasn't going to run for school board ever again. Then, 10 minutes later, he'd cave in because Otto Meyer had asked him, as if that explained anything. As if there were no way to predict in advance that, of course, Oscar goddamn Meyer would ask him. As if Oscar Meyer were the sort of man you couldn't say no to, when in fact everybody said no to him, including his staff, who was supposed to do what he told them. Or take American Legion Baseball. He was all done umpiring. Never again. That was in the morning. By afternoon, after all the coaches got together and begged him, just until they could find somebody else, he'd agree to one more year. Right. It was pathetic, really. And when Janine decided to divorce him, she'd added watching Miles get suckered into doing things he didn't want to do and swore he wouldn't do to the long list of things she wouldn't miss. And at first she didn't. It was only lately. Walt was a different breed of cat entirely, of course. Never one to draw a line in the sand and then rub it out 2 minutes later, and this had attracted her from the start. The problem, though, she had to admit, was that Walt wouldn't commit either to doing or not doing much of anything. The secret of his success, he was fond of reminding her, was keeping all his options open. There were times when zigging was called for, but on further reflection, you might want to zag. One of his favorite expressions was, "You know, a smart man might just..." And then he'd explain just what a smart man might do. In the beginning, Janine imagined these statements were actually connected in some way to his intentions, like they'd sell the house he owned and use the money to buy Miles out of their house. Nobody was going to come out of this divorce with much, but Miles was taking the worst beating, and it embarrassed the hell out of her when Walt just changed his mind. He'd quietly found a renter for his own house and now was consistently vague about how the whole thing would work out, money-wise. Once they were married, was the rent money going into their account or his? Miles, she feared, would never see the first dime. In fact, now that she thought about it, Walt hadn't said diddly about his finances in general, though, of course, this would change by law the minute they were married. Janine was more than a little curious about how much money there really was, and one of the ways she rationalized their shafting Miles was by promising herself to make sure he got his fair share later, once she could write checks against their joint account. There was the health club, of course, and now the rental house, and she'd gotten the impression he owned a couple other properties. She didn't know what they were exactly, or even where. Lately, he'd been talking about building a club in Fairhaven, which, despite being twice the size of Empire Falls, boasted only 2 small, seedy gyms. But then he'd also been considering expanding the Empire Falls facility, doubling the size of the fitness section now that area doctors were beginning to send workmen's comp patients in for rehab. A smart man, Walt speculated, might add a few indoor tennis courts, since the one they had was booked more or less constantly. But in all the time they'd been together, the Silver Fox had not yet turned even one of these mites into a wood. Janine's reflections were interrupted by the appearance of her daughter, who'd managed to slide unnoticed down the row behind them, and sat down next to her grandmother, who promptly gave her a big hug of the sort that she no longer allowed Janine to administer.
"How's life, Tickaroo?" B asked.
"Okay."
Her daughter looked, Janine had to admit, positively radiant in the early October sun. The poor child still didn't have much of a chest and no hips at all, but she was going to end up with a model's build, no doubt about it. Not that she deserved it. Earlier that year, when Janine had suggested she take some modeling classes, Tick had sneered that maybe she would, after her lobotomy, which had pissed Janine off even before she looked up the word lobotomy.
"Just okay?"
B said, as if she also had noticed how radiant her granddaughter looked today.
"Well, my snake painting got picked for the art show."
This was news to Janine, as well as the fact that Tick had painted a snake. What was not news was her daughter's treatment of her in public. There was an empty seat on Janine's left, the one Walt had vacated. But of course, Tick wanted no part of that. For one thing, Walt had touched it. So, as far as Tick was concerned, it was contaminated. At home, she no longer used the upstairs bathroom for the same reason. She preferred to go all the way down to the basement to shower in the dingy, unfinished bathroom off what had once been the rec room and was now crammed with all the shit Miles didn't have room for in his apartment. About 1,000 yard sale books, basically, which Walt was forever ragging her about, saying how nice it would be to have the use of the room. They could put a stationary bike down there and maybe even a Stairmaster so she, he seemed to mean, could work out while they watched television at night. It was bad enough that Tick couldn't stomach Walt, but lately she didn't want anything to do with anything Walt had touched, including Janine. Whenever Janine got too close, she'd wrinkle her nose and say, "Yuck, I can smell his aftershave on you," which she definitely couldn't smell. Not first thing in the morning, after Janine had taken her shower. No doubt about it, they were headed for a showdown, probably before the wedding, for which Tick had refused to be the maid of honor, even after Janine had asked her nicely. What Janine was gradually coming to understand was that her daughter was a formidable, clever opponent. Naturally, she had her father wrapped around her little finger. That was to be expected. But what baffled Janine was Walt. Even though Tick really exhibited anything but contempt for him, she somehow managed things so that he took her side in most disputes.
"I thought that teacher didn't like your snake," B was saying.
More news to Janine.
"They brought in some professor from Fairhaven to be the judge," Tick explained. "He and Mrs. Rodrigue got in an argument out in the parking lot. She told us the next day that Mr. Meyer was just trying to, quote-unquote, undermine her authority, like she has any."
"You caused all that trouble by painting a snake?"
"Art's controversial, Grandma."
"Excuse me," Janine said, leaning forward so she and her daughter could glare at each other. "At least say hello, okay? I'm not just somebody you sneak past without so much as a how do you do."
"I didn't sneak past," Tick said. "You weren't paying attention."
"I'm paying attention now, and you still haven't said hello."
"Tell your mother she should put a sweatshirt on," B said. "Tell her she looks cold."
"You do look cold, Mom."
"Tell her she's got goosebumps," B suggested.
Now Janine glared at her mother. "Remind me to invite you to the next football game."
"Your mother's in a pissy mood," B explained. "She wanted me to climb all the way up to the top of the bleachers on my aching feet, and I wouldn't do it."
"It's true I'm in a pissy mood, Beatrice, and it's true you aren't helping matters, but you're far from the cause, so don't flatter yourself."
"She's also embarrassed because I brought my hemorrhoid cushion to sit on," B added.
"Also true. What kind of woman would announce that particular affliction to the whole damn world?"
"Mother," Janine said, "you can show the people in the next row your actual hemorrhoids for all I care."
"It'd almost be worth it just to see the look on your face," B snorted, not fooled for a minute.
Her daughter still hadn't said hello, of course, but Janine suddenly felt overcome, not by anger, but by sadness. Her eyes filled with tears,
and she had to look away before anyone noticed. That morning, just before she and Walt had left for City Hall, the mail had arrived, much earlier than usual for a Saturday, probably so the carrier could finish his route and make it to the game. And among the junk flyers and bills, there was a small envelope addressed in a precise adolescent hand to Christina Roby, postmarked somewhere in Indiana. Impatient because Walt was dragging his feet again about going down to City Hall, Janine had tossed the letter on the hall table and forgotten about it, though she recalled it when they returned. Now she had only to look at her daughter to know its contents were responsible for Tick's glow. What called up the tears was the realization that her daughter would share exactly none of this with her. Hell, she wouldn't even have heard of this boy if Miles hadn't said something about him, clearly assuming she knew all about him. Since the separation, Tick had withdrawn all confidences, along with every outward sign of affection. Which hurt, of course, though Janine assured herself that her daughter would tire of this melodramatic attitude. After all, young girls needed their mothers. So far, though, Tick had shown no signs of relenting. Simple civility seemed to strain, and Janine suspected that even this was the result of a promise made to her father. Janine surreptitiously blotted her eyes on the sleeve of the sweatshirt in her lap and thought, okay, to hell with it. She'd earned her last chance at happiness, and by God, she was going to make the most of it. Anybody who didn't approve, well, just too damn bad, and that included her daughter, the little shit. She could just go ahead and keep her secrets, see if anybody cared. To prove she could pull off this posture, Janine turned her back on both her daughter and her mother. Down below, the Fairhaven and Empire Falls players were trotting back onto the field, halftime over. Janine did her best to act interested and upbeat, yet she couldn't help thinking how soon these limber cheerleaders, now doing backflips, would be married and then pregnant by these same boys or others like them a town or two away, and how swiftly life would descend on the boys as well. First the panic that maybe they'd have to go through it alone, then the quick marriage to prevent that grim fate, followed by relentless house and car payments and doctor bills and all the rest. The joy they took in this rough sport would gradually mutate. They'd gravitate to bars like her mother's to get away from these same girls. And then the children, neither they nor their wives, would be clever and independent enough to prevent. There would be the sports channel on the tavern's widescreen TV and plenty of beer. And for a while they'd talk about playing again. But when they did play, they'd injure themselves. And before long their injuries would become conditions. And that would be that. Their jobs, their marriages, their kids, their lives, all of it a grind. Once a year, feeling rambunctious, they'd paint their faces, pile into one of their wives' minivans, and even though it cost too much, head south to take in a Patriots game if the team didn't finally relocate somewhere to the south where all the decent jobs had gone. After the game, half drunk, they'd head home again, because nobody had the money to stay overnight. Home to Empire Falls, if such a place still existed. In their brief absence, a few of the more adventurous or desperate wives would seize the opportunity to hire a sitter and meet another of these boy men, permanent whiskey dicks, most of them, out at the Lamplighter Motor Court for a little taste of the road not taken, only to discover that it was pretty much the same shabby two-lane blacktop they'd been traveling all along. Just an unfamiliar stretch of it that nonetheless led to pretty much the same destination anyhow. Janine was sitting next to her own destiny, of course, and that destiny was itself perched on a damn hemorrhoid cushion. "Oh, leave the child alone, Walt," she heard her mother say. And she then saw through her tears that her husband-to-be had returned, no doubt sneaking down the row behind her just as Tick had done. Apparently he'd given his stepdaughter a kiss on the top of the head and had been handed his usual rebuff by way of thanks. "What makes you think a pretty 15-year-old girl wants to be kissed in public by an old goat like you?" B asked him. "'Cause I'm a good-looking old goat,
said Walt, whose sense of himself as a desirable male was not easily tilted. After a minute, though, he sensed trouble and came sideways down the row and settled onto the end of the bench next to the somebody whose whole damn world had just gotten tilted but good. Unless he was mistaken, those were tears in her eyes, tears that she was trying to conceal by pulling her sweatshirt on over her head. The only thing to do was cheer her up, so he began crooning an apropos lyric of Perry Como's.
The way that we cheered whenever our team was scoring a touchdown,
he warbled, nudging her in the idiotic hope of getting her to sing along. Perfect, Janine thought. At last she finally understood her husband-to-be's infatuation with Perry Como, which had nothing to do with the singer's good looks, charm, or silvery foxiness. The fucker was Walt's contemporary.
You know what I wish? She said, without even looking at him. I wish all of you would just leave me alone.
Time can erase the memory of...
Walt continued, not taking her warning seriously, the dumb SOB.
These magic moments filled with love.
That was the saddest part of all, Janine thought, now thoroughly awash in self-pity. She couldn't think of a single magic moment filled with love in her whole sorry life. And here she was, trying as hard as she could to deny it, closing in on Over the Hill. She glanced down when Fairhaven kicked off to Empire Falls, whose kick returner received the ball cleanly and sprinted upfield. When he successfully negotiated the first wave of would-be tacklers and the field began to open up before him, everyone in the stand stood to see if he would go the distance. Everyone except for Janine, who knew without looking that he wouldn't, and who, still seated, felt the crush of all the excited people stamping their feet and hollering in the rows above her. Janine understood about her mother's aching feet and why she hadn't wanted to climb all the way to the top as Janine had begged her. But damn, she'd hoped to get farther up than this.
Chapter 17. Jimmy Minty parked the cruiser right across the street from the Empire Grill, where Miles couldn't help but see it when he returned. He'd been sitting there for a while now, pondering the whole Miles Roby situation, but for some reason his mind had wandered onto Billy Barnes, whom he hadn't seen in years. Why Billy should pop into his head today of all fucking days, he had no idea, since it was Roby he felt like pounding to a bloody pulp. For all Jimmy knew, Billy Barnes could be dead. He wasn't playing pro hockey, that was for sure. Jimmy still followed the NHL closely and knew his old buddy had never made it, though everybody in Dexter County swore that he would. Of course, even if he had, Billy would be washed up by now. Why was it then that Jimmy still half expected to see him turn up on the ice some night during a Bruins game? So what had the kid who couldn't miss ended up doing? Jimmy Minty couldn't help wondering. What did you do when you were good at just one thing, after it turned out you weren't as good as you thought? Well, if you were smart, you probably did what Billy Barnes had done. You disappeared. Why hang around a place where all anybody remembered was that you hadn't made it? So how come, is what everybody would want to know. And who could blame them? Jimmy wouldn't have minded asking Billy Barnes that himself. Sure, there were people who wouldn't ask, but you'd see the question on their faces anyhow. After you said goodbye and started to walk away, you'd see them bend over and whisper something to their kid, and you'd know what it was. That guy back there? That was Billy Barnes, the best from around here ever to strap on the blades. Couldn't miss. Except he did.
Ambition, Jimmy heard his father say. It'll kill you every time.
William Minty had been dead for years, but his lectures had survived him. His only son, watching the parking lot and the street near the Empire Grill fill up with cars, could play them back in his mind more or less verbatim.
They got it all figured out,
the old man would announce from the threadbare old armchair he piloted in the evening. His father was always solemn and silent over dinner, but once in the living room, with Walter Cronkite on the television, he grew talkative. Cronkite, Jimmy suspected from his father's knowing nod, was one of the ones who had it all figured out.
Figured what out?
He'd found the courage to ask, just that once. His father regarded his son with curiosity, as if he couldn't figure out how any kid of his could be so stupid. He nodded at the TV again.
All of it, he explained,
then stared long and hard at Cronkite.
In school, they tell you it's a free country, I bet.
Jimmy couldn't deny that he'd heard this opinion expressed on more than one occasion.
Yeah, well, don't you believe it. They got the whole thing figured out, believe me. And they've thought of everything. Who they'll let you marry, where you and her are gonna live, how much the rent's gonna be, how much money you'll make, which ones are gonna die in their wars, all of it. You think you got a say? Think again.
Jimmy thought all this figuring had to be pretty complicated. It would require a lot of organization, and making everything come out right couldn't be easy. You'd have to depend on a lot of the same people his father complained couldn't manage to get you your unemployment checks on time, wouldn't you? He suggested as much to his father.
Yeah? Well, don't you worry, his father assured him. If you don't believe me, watch this know-it-all tell you how it is every night for about 20 years. And see if you don't think they've got it all figured out.
From where Jimmy sat in the living room, he was able to see the Roby house across the driveway. Many evenings, Miles's mother would pass behind their living room window, sometimes stopping to pull the curtains shut. At 9 years old, Jimmy had thought Mrs. Roby the prettiest woman he'd ever seen, including girls, and he wondered what it would be like to live in the same house as her. He guessed maybe it'd be different if she was your own mother, but he couldn't imagine not having the hots for Mrs. Roby no matter whose mother she was. He'd caught his father looking across the way a couple times, too. Jimmy had even made the mistake of telling Miles how lucky he was having her for a mother all to himself most of the time, Mr. Roby being gone as much as he was home. He'd also asked Miles if he'd ever seen his mother naked, hoping for a description. And Miles hadn't spoken a word to him for a week until he apologized, which Jimmy was quick to do because he was afraid Miles would tell his mother that he was a dirty boy. So Jimmy thought about what his father was telling him, about Walter Cronkite and the rest having it all figured out, and he hoped his father was wrong. He didn't like the idea of having somebody else decide who he'd marry. That was a choice he'd hoped to make himself, and he intended to marry someone who looked as much as possible like Mrs. Roby, or maybe Mrs. Roby herself, later, when he was old enough, if her husband died or disappeared completely. Nobody can figure out everything, Jimmy ventured hopefully.
No, his father said, watching Cronkite carefully so the other man wouldn't be able to put anything over on him. Well, maybe not everything. But they got the main things covered, that's for goddamn sure, and don't you ever doubt it, neither.
In a nutshell, his father's philosophy about how to deal with these people was not to appear ambitious. Don't call attention to yourself, was his advice. Keep your eyes open for opportunities, but don't get greedy. Steal small. Make sure if you're caught, they don't catch you with much. Remember the bother principle, as he called it. They won't bother you over little things, was the way his father explained his own thefts. Couple loins of venison turn up in your freezer down in the cellar. Who's going to bother you? Two or three big freezers full of hijacked deer. Too much. In fact, the bother principle could gauge the risks of just about any situation. You happen to find a key that opens the lock to somebody's storeroom. Lucky you. You lift the occasional bottle of cheap rye. Who's going to bother you over that? Chances are they don't even count the bottles of the cheap stuff, or if they do and one goes missing, maybe they miscounted. The brand name booze and case lots, those they counted. Those they looked for.
Better to steal the cheap one. When it's gone, steal another. You get the key, you keep the key. You tell exactly no one. If you don't get greedy, that key stays useful. You steal big, they change the lock, and now you don't have a key anymore. Keys were one of William Minty's hobbies. He made them down in the basement on a machine he'd got for a song when Olerud's hardware went bankrupt. Jimmy bolted upright when an old Volvo pulled up alongside the cruiser and proceeded to parallel park in the space behind it. He watched the driver get out, go around and open the door for the woman in the passenger seat. She was nicely dressed, but nothing much to look at. The man was dressed in chinos and a tweed sports coat over a light blue shirt with a button-down collar, and he was carrying something in a brown paper bag. Jimmy Minty disliked him immediately, probably even before he'd gotten out of the car. Not many men would parallel park if they had to start out next to a cop car. Whoever this asshole was, a professor by the look of him, he was pretty fucking sure of himself. He and his plain Jane woman crossed Empire Avenue without so much as a glance in his direction. And when they disappeared inside the Empire Grill, Jimmy turned in his seat so he could see the inspection sticker displayed on the windshield. Valid, unfortunately. His watch read 6:30. Jimmy had figured Roby would be back at the restaurant by now. It didn't take that long to drive across the Iron Bridge, deposit Cindy back at the Whiting House, and return. Unless old Miles managed to get himself invited inside. Though the possibility was not entirely pleasant, Jimmy had to smile. Mrs. Whiting was in Boston, he happened to know, so maybe Miles and her daughter were going at it on the sofa right now, Roby slipping it to her. That experience he was welcome to. A pickup truck, its horn honking, careened around the corner onto Empire Avenue. Four high school kids were wedged into the cab. No way more than two of them could be belted. And three more were standing up in the bed, the tallest blowing one of those long plastic horns. The driver, spotting the cruiser at the last second, stood on the brakes hard enough to cause the boys in the back of the cab to hang on for dear life, and the horn soared out over the side and rattled up the street after them, coming to rest into Jimmy's car. He considered going after them, reading the damn fool driver the riot act, maybe even issue a ticket, but then decided against it. They were just kids full of piss and vinegar after the big game. They'd gotten a good scare when they saw him and lost their horn to boot. They'd probably go slow now, at least for a while. Besides, if he chased after them, he'd lose his parking space for sure. As if to confirm this fear, another car pulled up next to the curb on the other side of the street, and yet another man in a tweed coat got out. Why did they all have to wear a uniform, these college professors? The woman with this guy was a dead ringer for the first one. If they had a plain-looking woman contest, these two would tie for seventh place, unless there was a swimsuit competition, and then they'd tie for ninth. His father had been right about that part, of course. You didn't get to marry the one you wanted. You married the best of whatever was left. Tweed married tweed. Flannel got flannel. As to whether ambition killed you every time, Jimmy Minty had his doubts. Professors. Maybe that's why he recollected Billy Barnes. After high school, Billy had gone off to the University of Maine on his hockey scholarship. He joined a frat house and invited Jimmy up to Orono one weekend for a party so he could see for himself what he was missing out on. It turned out to be one hell of a party, all right, and it was already in full swing by the time Jimmy Minty got there. Actually, he'd arrived earlier in the evening, but then drove around, trying to work up enough nerve to knock on the frat house door. In fact, he'd finished a six-pack before deciding what the hell. When he finally rang the bell, the door was answered by a big guy who had a 16-ouncer in his left hand and a passed-out, bare-assed girl slung over his right shoulder, her long, dark hair hanging straight down almost to the big kid's knees, her blue jeans and panties bunched around her ankles. Jimmy, trying to pretend that this wasn't such an unusual sight, explained that he was a friend of Billy Barnes, and the big kid said,
Like I give a shit. Grab yourself a brew. You want a sniff?
What?
Jimmy said, feeling angry and confused.
Dollar a sniff, he explained.
And then another guy came over and stuffed a wrinkled bill into his frat brother's shirt pocket, which Jimmy now noticed was full of them. This new kid asked Jimmy to step out of the way, then grabbed and lifted the girl's ankles so her knees rested on his shoulders. Then he leaned forward, inhaling deeply.
That, he said when he'd finished and let the girl's legs drop, is one sweet pussy.
So, the big frat kid said to Jimmy Minty, who hadn't moved, you want a sniff, or you just gonna stand there staring?
I was looking for Billy Barnes, Jimmy Minty reminded him. The kid nodded in drunken comprehension.
Nice ripe pussy and you're looking for Billy Barnes, he shrugged. To each his own.
Well, it was a pretty wild party. Jimmy drank a beer from one of three identical kegs, wondering if that was all he'd be allowed, not being a member of the fraternity. It was hard to imagine you'd get more than one freebie by dropping Billy Barnes's name, but apparently he was wrong. When he went back to the kegs, one of the frat boys tripped the spigot without ever looking at him, as if it were the proximity of the empty cup he was acknowledging and not the person holding it. The beer flowed through the tap slowly, and the boy kept talking to a girl, this one fully clothed, without feeling the need to check on Jimmy's cup. When he interrupted their conversation to ask if he'd seen Billy Barnes, the frat kid frowned and said,
"Who?"
When he woke up the next morning, Jimmy's head ached so bad that for a long time he just lay still, not even daring to open his eyes. He was vaguely aware of having spent a restless night, chased from one nightmarish dream to another. When he finally opened his eyes, he was in a strange room. Staring at the ceiling was about all he could manage, because even the slightest movement resulted in wave after wave of rolling nausea and pain. It was quiet, though, and from this he deduced that he was alone. Relieved, he closed his eyes and must have gone back to sleep, at least for a while, because when he opened his eyes again, the headache, while still nauseating, didn't seem quite as intense. What worried him was that whoever this room belonged to was likely to show up at any time and demand to know what Jimmy was doing in here. He wouldn't even know who Jimmy was unless by chance this happened to be Billy Barnes's room, and what were the odds on that? He couldn't remember much of what happened the night before, but he did recall asking after his old friend over and over and getting the distinct impression that Billy wasn't held in particularly high esteem by his frat brothers. Not that this surprised him all that much, since Billy didn't have many friends in high school either, except on the hockey team, and that was only because he could skate circles around just about anybody in Dexter County. At any event, if this wasn't Billy's bed, Jimmy thought he'd better vacate it as soon as possible. So he closed his eyes one last time, counted to three, sat up, and swung his legs onto the floor. Then he closed his eyes again, and waited for the crashing waves of pain in his head to subside. When they did, he immediately saw two things in the dim early morning light. The first was that he was naked, which put him in mind of the bare-assed girl everybody had been paying to sniff the night before, and in a wild, intuitive leap, he wondered if something of the sort might have happened to him after he passed out. Had he been removed to this bedroom and stripped naked, and offered up as a male specimen to curious female partygoers? No doubt he'd have lost the contents of his stomach right then if he hadn't noticed the second thing, which substituted cold fear for nausea. The dingy white sheet he'd been sleeping on was splotched wetly pink all the way up to the pillow, and when close examination revealed the sticky wetness to be exactly what he feared, blood, he vaulted quickly to his feet and backed away from the bed until he bumped into the far wall. This caused another terrific wave of pain in his head, this one so intense that he slid down the wall into a sitting position, where he remained,
his knees drawn up to his chest, his hands clasped around his ankles, his forehead resting against his knees. Again he closed his eyes and considered the blessing of darkness, the marvelous way it could subtract the whole world. There was a knock on the side window of the cruiser, and when he looked up, Zack had materialized on the other side of the glass. Jimmy rolled down the window and grinned. Lord, the boy was getting big. He offered his hand.
Hell of a game, son.
They shook awkwardly. Too bad we run out of time, said the younger Minty. They'd come back in the second half, tying Fairhaven on a field goal late in the fourth quarter. We would have scored again if we got the damn ball back.
That's for sure, Jimmy agreed. And they were all done scoring on you.
That they were, the boy said proudly.
Where are you off to now?
Across the street, Jimmy Minty's own Camaro idled throatily, double parked next to the second professor's car, and behind the Camaro sat the pickup that had screeched around the corner earlier. There was no one riding in the back now, and only three in the cab, for show, no doubt. The other kids were probably waiting around the corner to get picked up again. Thought we'd drive to Fairhaven for some pizza.
We got pizza right here in Empire Falls, you know.
I know, Zack said. But is it okay?
I guess. Who you got with you?
He peered around his son to see who was in the car, but the windows were rolled up, the Camaro's glass tinted. Justin, Tick Roby, girl named Candy Burke. His father nodded, waiting. There were four people in the car. He could see that much even through the tinted windows.
That's three, he said.
His son seemed reluctant to fess up to the last rider. Some kid named John.
John who?
Voss, I think. Jimmy nodded, trying to conjure up what he knew about that name. The kid had got caught shoplifting at the supermarket back in July. Jimmy had let him off with a warning. Not worth the bother. Weird kid, he remembered. Not the sort he would have figured his own boy would be hanging around with.
You ever get caught shoplifting, I'll kick your ass, you know.
I won't, the boy promised ambiguously.
I still can, you know.
Maybe.
Now the boy was grinning. Maybe my ass, Jimmy grinned back. You might be able to knock me down, but I wouldn't be like that kid you whacked today. I'd get back up.
I know you would, Dad.
You got enough money?
Yeah. Jimmy Minty nodded, then slipped him a 20 anyway. Take this. You can give it back if you don't need it. Which would be a first. Not that he minded, though. Jimmy didn't want a kid of his to be short, like he'd always been at that age. Getting a bent nickel out of his father had been an all-day job.
You stay out of trouble. This is a bad night for you to be going to Fairhaven after that game. You get thrown in jail for fighting, I'll let you sit there.
I'll remember.
Do.
I'm going now, okay?
How are you and that Roby girl getting along?
Oh, she's being a cunt as usual, pretending she doesn't like me. Jimmy considered telling him to watch his language, then decided against it. He'd used that word himself in reference to the boy's mother, who was one and who deserved it, like most of them did when you came right down to it.
Well, she wouldn't be her father's daughter if she didn't need to come down a peg or two. Don't take any shit is my advice.
He was just about through taking it himself, actually. I won't be late.
You wrecked that Camaro. I'm not going to give a good goddamn whose fault it was, Jimmy said, feeling the need for one last warning.
We could switch if you're worried, the boy said, wise ass.
Go on before I give you a ticket for double parking.
Zack nodded. Before crossing the street, though, he went around the cruiser and retrieved the plastic horn from the gutter, then trotted over and handed it to the driver of the pickup. The most obvious explanation for the bloody bed, he'd figured as he sat there with his eyes clamped tightly shut, was that he was still dreaming. After all, he'd been tormented by one terrible dream after another all night, their fragmented contents coming back to him now in flashes. This must simply be the latest installment. When he opened his eyes again, he'd be back in bed, maybe even his own bed, hungover but safe and sane. except that when he tested this theory, he found himself still seated at the base of the wall in some stranger's dorm room. The only difference was that he'd begun to whimper. Clearly, a terrible thing had happened here in the night, and since he was alive to witness its aftermath, it stood to reason that the act had not been done to him, though he now noticed that his own skin here and there was crusted with blood, but rather by him. For a long time, probably since he was 15 or 16, he'd been indulging dark, violent fantasies before going to sleep at night, and one of these, it seemed, had somehow come to life. He'd persuaded some girl to come up to this room with him last night, and then she'd pissed him off, and he'd killed her. He vaguely remembered trying to convince several different girls to have sex with him the night before. As far as he could remember, none of them had been even remotely tempted, but one of them must have said yes. Once again, he felt his stomach heave. Despite the psychological plausibility of this scenario, Jimmy Minty took some solace from the lack of supporting physical evidence. If he'd killed some poor sorority girl, then where was she? He got onto his hands and knees and crawled over to where the bedclothes were balled up at the foot of the bed and lifted them up. No girl there. He then padded around to the other side of the bed. Still no girl. Next, he checked out the closet, which was full of all manner of shit except a dead girl. Was it possible he tried to kill her and she'd somehow managed to escape? He poked his head out into the hallway, half expecting to see a trail of blood. There was a large foamy stain on the wall, but that almost certainly was beer. He closed the door again. Okay, so maybe he hadn't killed anybody after all, but somebody had bled like a stuck pig all over the bed. Much of the blood was already dry and crusty, like the spots on his knees and stomach and chest. In other places, it was still sticky and moist. Sitting down on the edge of the bed, Jimmy thought for a moment, then reached down and took a clean corner of the top sheet and wiped a spot of dried blood off his knee, surprised that it stung when he did so, and that bright beads of blood began forming slowly along what he now recognized as a tiny cut. How wonderful to discover that the blood was his own, that his whole body was covered by tiny, razor-thin cuts. True, it made him weak to consider that so much blood should have leaked from his own person, but at least he wasn't a murderer. He'd planned on applying to the Maine Police Academy, and it wouldn't look good on his application if he'd gone and killed some girl at a frat party, even if he explained that he was drunk at the time and didn't remember. It had taken him the better part of a year to come up with the police academy idea, and he didn't want to have to start all over, even with the leisure of a lengthy prison sentence to develop other career possibilities. No, if the blood was his own, it meant that he could still be a cop, and what the present circumstance called for, it occurred to him, was some detective work. How on earth had he managed to wake up covered with cuts he didn't remember getting? It was a puzzle. He'd heard plenty of stories about wild frat parties, about a bizarre ritual called hazing that the older members inflicted on the pledges. Mostly the pledges were just driven out into the country someplace, their clothing confiscated, and left there to make their humiliating way back to campus, or else they were forced to drink until they passed out. Maybe something along these lines had happened last night. It was his understanding that in order to be hazed, you first had to pledge the frat, but who knew? Maybe he'd been mistaken for a Sigma Nu pledge. Of course, no one had forced him to drink until he passed out. He'd done that all on his own. But he'd awakened completely naked, and that was suggestive. Was it possible that all these tiny cuts had been inflicted on him by drunk frat boys playing a prank? Good Lord, there was even one on his dick. The good news was that his clothes were wadded up among the bedclothes, and Jimmy climbed into them gingerly. Movement of any sort opened the various cuts and made them sting all over again, but there was no help for it. The house was still quiet, everyone drunkenly asleep, he assumed, so the thing to do was slip out quietly before anybody else woke up and wondered who the hell he was and what he was doing there. The question was, Should he take the bloody sheets with him? On the other hand, they weren't his, and he didn't want to be regarded as a thief. On the other, removing them would be a kindness to the owner of the room, who would therefore be spared the shock and mystification of all that blood. Besides, the whole damned fraternity would probably be convinced a murder had taken place, and when they sobered up, somebody might remember it was Billy Barnes's weird friend they'd let crash in there. That would take some explaining, and Jimmy Minty doubted his ability to do so convincingly, when he only partially comprehended what might have happened himself. So best to swipe the sheets. When he began to strip the bed, he noticed glinting, as if the bloody sheet had been sprinkled here and there with stardust. On closer inspection, it turned out to be shards of paper-thin glass. Jimmy studied a tiny shaving that embedded itself in the tip of his thumb when he tried to pick it up. He sat back down on the bed to think it through, and after a minute, raised his head to look at the ceiling. Directly overhead was an empty light fixture. No, not empty. A ragged piece of thin glass jutted out of the socket, all that was left of the exploded light bulb. No wonder his sleep had been restless. He'd been sleeping in a bed of broken glass. The mystery solved, he decided to leave the sheets after all and see if anybody else could follow the clues and solve the mystery. Down the block he found his car right where he'd left it the night before, and he slid gingerly behind the wheel, his buttocks a grid of nicks. Right in front of him was another frat house with two Greek symbols displayed above the door. This got him thinking. The frat he'd gone into the night before had three symbols above the door. Sigma Nu was what Billy Barnes had said when he gave Jimmy the address. Would that be two symbols or three? Sigma Nu, three. The drive back to Empire Falls was uncomfortable, but Jimmy Minty smiled the whole way, confident he'd make a hell of a fine policeman. He was also glad he'd visited the University of Maine. It took most kids a full 4 years there to discover their true vocation, but he'd figured it out on his own in just one night. The police car, parked in plain sight across the street, was the first thing Miles saw when he returned from the Whiting Hacienda. Ignore it, he told himself. The restaurant looked every bit as busy as it had been last night, which meant they could use his help inside. He drove around back, parked in his usual spot beside the dumpster, and started toward the back door, then thought again, heading around the building and out into the street. Jimmy Minty had opened the door and gotten out of the cruiser before Miles even stepped off the curb, and he looked pretty surprised when Miles stuck his hand out, maybe a little disappointed, too, because he was none too quick to take it. "I'm sorry about this afternoon, Jimmy," Miles said once they'd shaken hands. "I don't know what got into me. I'm tired, I guess." "Well, it's good of you to apologize. I guess I figured this thing between us was going to get worse." "I wouldn't want that," Miles said truthfully. "You were right. I don't need any enemies. I certainly don't want to make one of you." Jimmy nodded warily. It took him a minute to satisfy himself that there wasn't any irony or sarcasm in what Miles was saying. "Why don't you come around and sit a minute? Sit, I mean. You were right, I always get that wrong. Sit and set. Old Lady Lampley used to mark it with her red pen. You remember her?" Miles nodded. "I can't stay long," he said, going around to the other side of the cruiser. "It looks like the restaurant's full." "You afraid they can't handle things without you?" Minty said, when Miles slid in and he himself had settled back behind the wheel. "No," Miles shook his head. "I'm more afraid they can." Jimmy nodded, as if this wisdom was too profound to swallow whole. After a beat, he said, "This is more like it. Me and you, just talking, not getting bent out of shape." Miles nodded back. Unless he was mistaken, this was an offer to apologize a second time, or perhaps to offer a fuller, more satisfactory explanation of their confrontation. "So what is this thing between us?" the policeman asked, confirming Miles' suspicion. "I mean, I understand tired, but that this afternoon? That didn't seem like tired.
It was something all right, but it didn't seem like tired. And before with your dad, that didn't seem like tired either.
What did it seem like? Miles asked, both curious and hopeful that whatever Jimmy Minty came up with wouldn't be too close to the truth.
That's what I've been parked here trying to figure out.
Look, I shouldn't have corrected your grammar, Jimmy. That was condescending and mean-spirited. You're right to be pissed off.
The other man didn't say anything for a second, but then threw his hands up in the air so unexpectedly that Miles flinched.
Ah, to hell with it. You said you were sorry, right?
This, Miles noted, was a third opportunity.
I saw the kids earlier, Minty said, regarding him carefully. Mine and yours, bunch of others. Heading over to Fairhaven for pizza, or so they claimed.
I'm not so sure that's a great idea.
Exactly what I said, Minty nodded once more. Then again, 2 more years and they'll both be off in college and we won't have a clue what they're doing, am I right?
I guess that's true, Miles pretended to agree.
You ever wish you were young again?
Never, Miles said, glad he could answer at least one of these questions with unadorned truth. It was awful.
Oh, I don't know.
We were stupid, Miles said, surprised by the depth of his conviction. I was, anyway.
You know what I was thinking before you showed up? I was remembering how Billy Barnes had me come up to UMO that time. Must have been the year after him and me graduated.
He went on to tell Miles about the frat party, or at least the part about the boy with the naked girl over his shoulder.
Boy, it made me mad, he concluded. At the time, I didn't even realize.
Well, it was a horrible thing, Miles agreed, trying not to imagine his own daughter at her first college kegger. Jimmy Minty looked at him blankly.
Oh, the girl, he said, blinking. Yeah, I guess that was pretty shitty. But what really pissed me off was those frat boys. How they all knew what was going on, the way they treated you like some fucking idiot because they understood and you didn't. Was it like that where you went?
Miles couldn't help smiling. I went to a tiny Catholic college, Jimmy. You saw more in your first 5 minutes on campus than I did in 3.5 years.
I don't mean that, Jimmy Minty said, growing visibly irritated at not being understood. I'm not talking about pussy. I'm talking about the way they all make you feel, like they belong and you don't, like they don't even have to look at you. Was it like that with the Catholics?
Miles studied him carefully. Dusk was falling, and even in the dim light of the front seat, Miles could see that the man's face was red with recollected outrage. Something about the combination of innocence and urgency in his question suggested the latter stages of intoxication, though the policeman displayed none of the other symptoms. It was as if Minty had posed the question in his mind all those years ago and hadn't had the opportunity to ask it until now. For this reason, Miles took his time answering.
There were times when I felt out of place, I suppose, he admitted. Times I felt inadequate, especially at the beginning. There were lots of kids from Boston, even Portland. Big city kids who knew plenty of things I didn't. But then at some point you realize you don't feel so incompetent anymore. One morning you wake up in your dorm room and think, this is my bed I've been sleeping in. That's my desk, and those are my books, and this is my world. After that, it's home that starts feeling strange. The other man had been listening carefully, and Miles realized that, despite his care, what he just said had confirmed some dark suspicion Minty couldn't or wouldn't let go of.
So I didn't stay long enough, is what you're telling me.
Well, one night, one party.
You're saying if I stayed longer, I would have become one of those frat boys.
Actually, Miles had no doubt of it. By his sophomore year, Jimmy Minty would have been the boy with the naked girl over his shoulder. But he knew better than to say this.
No. Well, then I'm glad I didn't stay.
Jimmy. No, fuck it, Miles. I'm trying to tell you something here, okay? You mind if I tell you something, or do you know it all?
Again, Miles paused before answering. There's no reason to get worked up, Jimmy. You asked me a question, and I answered it.
Now just shut up a minute. Here's the deal. I'm not getting worked up, okay? I've been worked up since this afternoon.
You think you can make fun of me in front of Miss Whiting and a bunch of other people, then come over here and say you're sorry when there's nobody around to hear you and that squares things? And you know what? It would have, except I saw that look on your face when I mentioned your daughter and Zach. I saw it, all right. Don't tell me I didn't, okay? Because that's just insulting me all over again.
Miles put his hand on the door handle. I'm sorry I upset you, Jimmy.
No, you just sit here a minute. Take your hand off that door till I finish.
Miles did as he was told.
I'm trying to tell you that's what's between you and me, not some bullshit like how tired you are. See, this town doesn't seem strange to me. It never did, not for one second. After that night in Orono, when I crossed the bridge into Empire Falls, right then was about the happiest minute in my whole damn life. You can laugh all you want, but it's true.
I'm not laughing, Jimmy.
See, I cared who won that football game today. Maybe people like you think that makes me a nobody. But you know what? I don't give a fuck. Mr. Empire Falls, that's me. Last one to leave, turn out the lights, right? This town is me, and I'm it. I'm not one of those that left and then came back. I've been here all along. Right here is where I've been, and it's where I'll be when the sun comes up tomorrow. So if you...
I never said... Thing is, Miles, people in this town like you. A lot of people. You got friends, even some important friends, I admit it. But here's something that might surprise you. People like me, too. Something else? I got friends. Might surprise you to hear, we even got some of the same friends. You're not the only one people like, okay? And I'll tell you something else. What people around here like best about me, they like it that they're more like me than they are like you. They look at me and they see the town they grew up in. They see their first girlfriend. They see the first high school football game they ever went to. You know what they see when they look at you? That they ain't good enough. They look at you and see everything they ever done wrong in their lives. They hear you talk and maybe they're thinking the same thing you are, except they can't say it like you do, and they know they won't ever get any credit. They see you and your buddy the principal with your heads together deciding how things are gonna be, talking the way you talk and making your little jokes, and they know they'll never get no place with either one of you, not ever. But me? Maybe they just might get someplace with me, and that's why they like me. That's why I'll probably be the next chief of police. They like my attitude, I guess you could say. And you know what? An attitude like yours leads to things.
Miles had finally had enough.
Are you threatening me, Jimmy?
He asked. Because you aren't the chief of police yet. Does Bill Dawes know who's taking his job?
Just a flicker of fear registered behind Minty's eyes as he calculated whether he'd gone too far, but then it was gone.
Threatening you? He said, incredulous. Threatening you? When did I ever want to be anything except your friend? Tell me that. When?
And of course Miles knew that in the twisted, grotesque way of many true things, Jimmy Minty was speaking straight from the heart. It was what he wanted, and he was genuinely mystified as to why he couldn't seem to have it. Which did not, Miles had to admit as he got out of the car and crossed Empire.